for over 50 years. Information at hillsboroughhouse.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sarah Ashworth in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Debate on gambling going on in the State House this week, one lawmaker said no bill has had this much scrutiny before. Governor Hassan's push for a high-end, highly regulated casino appeared to bring new life to the gambling debate that has gone on for years in the state. For supporters of the idea, casino licensing fees would help replenish the state's coffers to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. To detractors, gambling is a bad idea, tarnishing the state's image as a family-friendly state. This week, the Senate, meanwhile, buckled down on its version of the budget. Various departments came before the Senate to make their fiscal case, including the University System of New Hampshire, which is hoping for a substantial boost in funding after huge cuts in the last budget. The House dashed those hopes somewhat, though, cutting $12 million from Hassan's budget. But university officials tried to persuade the Senate to restore that amount. And some money from a tobacco settlement could mean a little less pressure for lawmakers in balancing the budget. That's just a few of the many stories that happened this week. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And let's hear from you today. What stories have you been following this week? The budget conversations, the gambling, the debate, the discussion on Stand Your Ground, or the controversial Facebook comment made by one state representative on the Boston Marathon bombings. You can call in the exchange number at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email. That's exchange at nhpr.org. Or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. Our guests here joining me in the studio for the hour, Kevin Landrigan. He's State House and political reporter for the Nashua Telegraph. Dean Spiliotis, he's civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website NewHampshirePoliticalCapital.com. And Dan Toohey, he's assistant regional editor for Patch.com in New Hampshire. Welcome, all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right.
Great
well, let's start. Let's start, Dan, with you, with one of the session's most controversial pieces of legislation. This is a bill that repeals the 2011 law known as Stand Your Ground. The Senate Judiciary Committee heard testimony on Tuesday. Supporters of the repeal, they say they want the law to go back to what it was. Can you remind us briefly kind of what that was and what this repeal is?
Yes. This is a bill that was sponsored by the House Majority Leader, Steve Shurtleff. It did pass the House rather easily with the Democratic majority in that chamber. It's now before the Senate, and the Senate Judiciary Committee had a hearing on it Tuesday, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And the bill would repeal the Stand Your Ground provision that was enacted in the last session. And the issue here, according to supporters, is if you can retreat safely without using force, you should do so. And supporters of this bill say, well, that's been the law since 1977, I believe. You know, it was no trouble then. It wasn't challenged in the courts. We don't need this. Now, so, opponents of the repeal of this bill, they really want, you know, this is a, they could see this as a personal defense issue, of course, and a gun rights issue. And it's really the big issue with this upcoming week is whether or not this will have any support in the Senate. In the Senate, of course, the Republicans have a 13-11 edge. And, you know, the latest developments here are some Democrats maybe against this repeal.
Right. We heard this week from Senator Andrew Hosmer. We've also heard from Jeff Woodburn, who are both Democrats, and saying that they will not support the repeal. Kevin, I know that you were there at the testimony this week in the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. What did you hear? What did people talk about?
Sure, Sarah. The two sides certainly disagree about a lot with regard to this legislation, but both of them made the point that they didn't believe it was a gun rights issue. They both essentially say that, but for different reasons. People who support the law as it now exists say it's not a gun rights issue because they don't want to upset the gun lobby. And folks who support certainly trying to repeal this law really feel as if as Dan said, this law was in place for 35 years. There weren't any problems with it. Why can't we go back to the way things used to be?
Right. And so a lot of the testimony, I know that there was really split testimony. There were people who got up and talked about it as a personal self-defense issue. There was a man in a wheelchair, I know, who got up there and said, "What do you expect somebody in my position to do? I cannot get up and run away." What seemed to be the tone of people who were testifying?
Yeah, it was civilized for the most part. There weren't a lot of angry people, certainly, but forceful presentations were made. A number of folks who support Stand Your Ground essentially argued that it was a women's issue, that women in public are less likely to be able to overcome an aggressor on their own, so they need a weapon to protect themselves, and this would allow them to use that.
And this was an argument I know was heard in the House debate, too. Dean, why do you think this is something that carries through? This is an argument we keep hearing.
Absolutely. I think it's important to put this issue in the larger political culture. Over the last several years, we've seen a push in a number of states by gun rights advocates. The larger context is this fear that the Obama administration is going to slowly take away gun rights, whether it's an assault weapons ban or limiting how much ammunition you can have, that this is sort of a civil rights issue or a Second Amendment issue. And so even though we've had this argument from supporters who say, well, the law's been fine for several decades, there is this kind of fear among people who do not want the repeal that it goes against kind of the libertarian culture we have in the state, the sort of pro-gun culture, the hunting culture, the individual self-defense culture that we have in the state. So, I think under different larger political circumstances, if we didn't have this larger trend or narrative in the country about gun rights, you might not see this push to keep the law on the books. There's a sense that, if it's not written into the law, that the government may try to slowly chip away at those rights.
Hmm. Kevin, I'm curious, did anybody bring up the Boston Marathon bombings in the testimony with Stand Your Ground?
No, not really. It didn't. It didn't really come up. I think I think there's been a desire. We've seen that on legislation in general in the last couple of weeks to kind of try to steer clear of that subject and not try to use it for political purposes.
Hmm. So, Dan, I know this bill, the bill to repeal, passed very narrowly in the House, as you said, 189 to 184. Any sense of what might happen here next? Are the chances good in the Senate?
No, I think, with I think it was Jeff Woodburn and, as you mentioned earlier, Andrew Hosmer, if they do side with the Republican caucus on this, the bill's not going to make it. It's dead.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the budget. That was a lot of what the State House was doing this past week as well. The Senate did not meet in session this week, but they had lots of committee work. Kevin, can you catch us up on what work is being done on the budget in the Senate right now?
Sure. We're sort of we're in that stage of the budget debate now where, like in a hockey game, when two guys get really upset at one another and it looks like they're going to have a fight, they sort of circle around the ice for a while before anybody actually – they wait for the other guy to throw the first punch. That's what's happening? That's what's happening in the Senate right now. They're taking their time sort of going through the document carefully that the House has passed. But we know the Senate's going to make a lot of changes. They're going to cut probably a fairly significant amount of spending. They believe this budget is as much as $100 million really out of balance. So we fully expect that to happen. This past week also was sort of what I call the whining week, where you have agency heads essentially come in and whine about what they didn't get in the House budget that they want. Many of them, of course, making the case that we like the governor's budget better than we like the budget that passed the House. Not really unusual for agency heads to say they support their chief executive more than they support the legislative leadership. And they're essentially making the case for her that we need a casino, we need that $80 million license fee, and that's the argument they're making as well, kind of self-consciously.
Yeah, and a number of Republicans have said that they're not necessarily going to count on that casino licensing fee because it's not in the House plan, and if the legislature doesn't adopt casino gambling, they wouldn't have that money. So when you ask them, okay, well, where is the balance going to come from? They say it's not going to be revenue increases. So, things like the gas tax or the cigarette tax, it's going to be from spending cuts, as you suggested. So that's going to really sort of change the tenor of the debate. If it becomes about what to cut rather than the appropriate level of revenue enhancement, it's going to change the debate. But the casino gambling is still sort of the big wild card here.
And today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Granite State reporters are talking about the latest goings-on around the state. We're starting off by talking about some of the action in the legislature. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR, or you can email exchange@nhpr.org. Let us know what news caught your eye this week. Let's keep going talking about the casino a little bit, Dan. These three working groups for the House Finance and the Ways and Means Committees, they held more informational sessions this week. What did these subcommittees examine this week?
Well, there are three subcommittees. We're looking at revenue, regulations, and community impact. They're still making their way. They're being very meticulous, it would almost seem, trying to make sure that no stone is left unturned. And of course, you have the anti-casino people saying every step of the way, saying, see, this is why we shouldn't do it. Governor Hassan, of course, is saying this is necessary for the budget, for critical state services, and some similar themes that we've heard for months, really, and we will hear them again for two more months. Until the FY fiscal year 2014 begins on July 1. But it's really fascinating to see what the public is doing and their interaction with these citizen legislatures.
Kevin, you're nodding.
Yeah, one of the things these subcommittees has done, which is really interesting, they're making greater use of Skype and other services so they can actually have experts from outside the state who aren't able to come in on such short notice to give testimony. So they talked with the Social Impact Committee I sat in on this week, talked with experts on addicted gambling from both Alberta, Canada, and from California to talk to folks about how likely are we to have more addicted gamblers, where are they going to come from. Many of the studies have essentially shown, for example, that there's you're 10 times more likely to become an addicted gambler if you live within a 10-mile radius of that particular casino. We have a Littleton man who used to operate a slots parlor in Oregon, and he's kind of become an anti-gambling advocate. He came in and urged them not to do this, talking about how he would see people come in and cash their paychecks and leave with no money at all.
So we'll continue talking about a casino in a minute. We're going to take a short break. You can join our conversation at 1-800-892-6477. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mike Daniele. NHPR earned three prestigious Edward R. Murrow Awards for outstanding journalism this year. You can tune in every day to hear our award-winning coverage of New Hampshire and the world. Sunshine today, some clouds rolling in by the afternoon, bringing a slight chance of an afternoon shower. Highs in the 60s. Mostly cloudy tonight, then turning clear overnight, lows in the 30s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from K.A. Perry Real Estate, specializing in older homes and nearby acreage by assisting buyers and sellers of all types of Wolfboro area real estate. Information at olderhomesnh.com. And from the Derryfield School, a 9th to 12th grade day school, inspiring students to find their passion for academics, athletics, and the arts. Open house May 2nd, online at derryfield.org/visit.
This is The Exchange. I'm Sarah Ashworth, in for Laura Canoy. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're talking about top stories that Granite Staters were talking about this week. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-NHPR or 1-800-892-6477 or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. We were just talking a little bit about casino legislation, which is still making its way through the State House. Dean Spiliotis, you were mentioning that this is a casino debate we've heard before.
Absolutely. As I was saying during the break, I lived in Chicago for 10 years before I moved here. There was a debate over riverboat casino gambling raging in Illinois. I've now spent 30 years in two states hearing the same exact debate with no significantly new insights in terms of the arguments for or against. You know, maybe we can talk a bit about the issue of Massachusetts and how that might affect New Hampshire. But the fundamental arguments on each side are really the same. So I just would be at this point, it'd be nice to just vote and let's sort of see
it
where
over
we are.
And done
right,
with.
Because I can't, you know, I can't read another round of the same testimony on both sides because I've been listening to it for 30 years.
Right. Dan,
yeah, to that end, it is a numbers game. It always has been. And it's not the numbers we're talking about are not the revenues or projected revenues. It's how many votes they may get in the House. And this past Wednesday, I attended the briefing supporters, you know, the New Hampshire Building and Trades Council, NEA, you know, State Troopers Association. They held a briefing at the State House cafeteria, and that's they were talking about the pros or the benefits from what they see for casino gambling. However, really, they're trying to get those reps who are on the fence. And there are a lot of people on the fence. They may be one way or the other, but they haven't really said what they're going to do.
So they're making the case that this means more jobs for people in the state, essentially?
Yes, yes. And it, you know, positive for the economy, positive for state services, positive for local communities. And they, of course, discount the social impact that opponents are saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, we saw this week that Massachusetts is moving forward slowly with its casino plans. Yesterday, we saw that the city of Everett announced an agreement with Steve Wynn to build a casino. He wants to build a $1 billion casino on the Mystic River. This still needs state approval, but there's some talk now that a New Hampshire casino could be built only for about $340 million, and with that $80 million in licensing fees added on to what's written in the bill of $425 million. So how might that compare to a $1 billion casino in Massachusetts? I saw there was a union leader editorial this week that said, quote, New Hampshire is preparing to become a low-end casino ghetto. Is that something that lawmakers are talking about, Kevin?
Yeah, it is, certainly. And you're right. When you look at the scale of the developments in all of the casinos they're talking about in Massachusetts, they're at least $1 billion. Some of them as much as $2 billion, and New Hampshire's bill essentially only requires an investment of $425 million. Now, supporters point to this study commission that's in the bill as one of their arguments. And the commission is to look at a number of things once we have a casino in place. The first charge essentially is, should we have more casinos? Should there be other sites? Is one casino serving our entire population? And should we have another casino near, if we have one in Salem, should we have one near the Vermont border and attract gamblers from those neighboring states? But the commission's job is also to look at these facilities, even if we just stick with one casino. Is this big enough? Are there enough amenities? Should there be more development required on the site? And certainly... So they could well recommend in the future that this be a bigger casino. There be more investment here. And there hasn't been a lot of public discussion about it. But as we know, the leading contender for a casino is Millennium Gaming, that has the option to buy Rockingham Park in Salem. And certainly in talking with officials in Salem, there is some belief down there, at least, that this development can be only so big on that site. There are water and sewer issues there. There's also a lot of demolition and that will have to occur, and some environmental impacts that may occur once you do that. So there is this concern about the Millennium Gaming property that this development can't be a $2 billion property with 30
restaurants and spas
and hotels and the rest of it, that it couldn't support a mega casino. That's one of the reasons why folks that own the Green Meadow Golf Course in Hudson essentially say, we'll build a destination. We'll spend at least $1 billion to do it. We'll have hotels. We'll have restaurants. We're going to have a PGA Championship golf course. We can support that kind of mega casino, not, as critics call this proposal, a convenience casino, one that would be so small that it would really only attract bettors from New Hampshire, and gamblers in Massachusetts would go to the more lavish properties.
And, of course, this is really hard to know in advance, Dan Tuohy.
Well, the casino free or die people, they say the same thing. Like, it's a monopoly, but they also say if this ever does become law, it's going to be challenged in court for many reasons, that, according to the opponents.
Okay. And Dan, what's the timing of all this in the State House? Could the House's casino vote come at about the same time that the Senate is looking at the budget, and would that shake it up a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. The two chambers are going concurrently here, and I don't know the exact schedule for either chamber, but it's coming down.
Yeah, it's interesting about that that timing, and it's very important. The Senate Finance Committee really hasn't declared definitively when we're going to finish with this budget, when we're going to recommend it. The only deadline is really that the Senate has to act by June 6th. The House Super Committee on Gambling has sort of tipped its hand. We're going to bring the gambling bill to the House by May 27th. So it's my belief, although it's not been stated publicly, that the Senate's going to wait for that gambling vote. Mm-hmm. And once that gambling vote comes, then we have Memorial Day weekend. Then the Senate Finance Committee will react to that gambling vote. And don't assume if a casino dies in the House that the casino money won't be in the Senate budget. It really depends on how close that vote is. If it looks as if it's possible that Governor Hassan can convince enough wavering Democrats that voted no the first time to support a budget with the $80 million in it in a conference committee report, the Senate may well go forward.
There are a lot of pieces in play here, huh? So you can join the conversation today at 1-800-892-6477. Let's go to a call now from Moses in Concord. Go ahead, Moses.
Hi. I was just wondering because I like the idea of a casino in New Hampshire, and it doesn't bother me so much. However, I would like to clarify. If a casino were to pass and be built, how do you make sure that it's going to be regulated by the state? How does the state get its revenue, or is it purely a private venture? Because I guess I have a trouble understanding if this is to create revenue for the state, how do we give a private enterprise the ability to run that particular casino?
That's a good question. That's a good question, Moses. Kevin Landrigan?
Well, the bill pretty clearly lays out what this profit-making company is going to have to do, which is they're going to have to pay 25% net tax on gambling that occurs at the slot machines to the state. Another 5% will actually go to the host communities, the surrounding communities, and also for addicted gambling. So 25% from the slots, that's net profit for the business from the slot machines will go to the state. These table games, there'll be up to 150 table games where poker is played, blackjack. The tax on those winnings is only 14%.
Dean?
Yeah, interestingly enough, one of the criticisms to get to Moses' question is that some casino advocates have suggested that you really need to put the regulatory infrastructure in place before you do the casino licensing. And what's unusual about the way Governor Hassan is doing it is she is going for the casino legislation at the same time they would be developing the regulatory infrastructure. So there's some question that that's problematic because other states have said you really need to have that regulatory infrastructure in place ahead of time rather than doing it simultaneously. And the other issue is obviously with budget cuts and a tight budget, there's some concern that there won't really be the resources to put towards effective regulation, which then gets into the whole issue of the impact of it on the society.
Yeah, just my one point, like Moses, I think what he was getting at was like the state would not be running the casinos in this bill. And I think there's only two or three states in America that actually run casinos. So I think it's a track record where the state on this bill, if it does come to fruition, it'll be, have the licensee and then have the state authority via the New Hampshire Lottery Commission and, of course, the state leaders. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your call, Moses. Let's go now to Russell, who's calling in from Dublin. Hi, Russell. Go ahead.
Good morning. For many years, I lived in Lyme, Connecticut, which is adjoining Foxwoods Casino. And when Foxwoods was proposed to the people of Connecticut, no domestic funding could be found for it. So the money to build Foxwoods came from Malaysia. And the money to build Mohegan Sun, that was built slightly later, came from South Africa. And I am quite sure in my own mind that New Hampshire will be dealing with international investors, not with domestic owners, and that the money behind Millennium Gaming is also international. And I think that that'll surprise some people. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that call, Russell. Kevin Landrigan, is this something that's been talked about? Could there be international investors here?
Yeah, it's a really good point, Russell. That hasn't been discussed a great deal. It sort of makes some sense in that, in one respect, and that is we have casinos operating in some form in 40 states right now. It's entirely possible that the domestic financing market, if you will, has been saturated with this business. And as we've seen certainly during this recession, gambling revenue is discretionary. And when recessions occur, actually desperate financial people, you would think, may go to the casino and try and make their money there. But the fact is gambling revenue plummeted during this recession. And I think it is one of the reasons why some investors are leery about casino gambling in the future as a stable revenue source
forward. The reality of the economy is that we have a globalized economy. It's not at all unusual to have international financing. You know, there was some sort of implicit concern that Russell had about international financing that maybe it was the particular countries he cited, but I wish he had expanded a little bit upon that. But that's just kind of the reality. You know, I don't know where Millennium is going to get the funding from, but it could be international sources, but that's not particularly unusual.
No.
Today on The Exchange, it's our New Hampshire Friday News Roundup. We're taking your calls and emails as well. Email exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. Dan Tuohy, moving on, the stakeout word this week that some tobacco settlement money is coming through to the tune of about $15 million, and it could help balance out this current budget. Is this as good as it sounds?
Well, anytime you get more money than you expected, it's great. Bring it on. $15 million more than anticipated. But the key phraseology, I think, was expressed by Governor Hassan in her announcement about it, underscoring, I think, three times using the FY13. This would go to the budget deficit in fiscal year 2013. We're trying to compare apples to apples here with budget years. We're trying to wrap up to FY 2013. FY 2014 and 15, the budget, the legislature is now working on with the governor and various agency heads, begins July 1. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's definitely a positive development, but how it goes forward with actually the budget discussions going on now is remains to be seen.
Yeah,
Kevin?
Dan's right. I mean, she emphasized that that this is not only is it found money, it's spent money. And by that, I mean this doesn't require the approval of the legislature, or this legislative fiscal committee that meets every month. The money's in the coffers. It's been paid. And she emphasized that essentially because the House budget spent this money in the next 2 years in their budget. They actually appropriated – they counted on roughly $23 million coming in from this tobacco settlement. We're going to get more than $15 million. In a couple of weeks, we could get as much as a few million dollars more. It's important to point out over the tobacco settlement – what happens in future years is actually our tobacco settlement contribution that we get is going to drop by a few million dollars for the next 5 years. We don't pay all of that extra money back, but we pay some of that extra money back. But she's making the point it's going to be spent now. It's going to eliminate the deficit or help eliminate the deficit. It's also not going to require that she raid dedicated funds that she had intended to do. And she's making this point very forcefully, essentially to say, look, subliminally, if you will, the House budget's out of balance. They spent they've got $23 million in there that isn't going to be there. So that's why you need the casino license fee money.
Yeah, it's almost as though they were surprised that the money showed up as quickly as it did and said, hey, wait a minute, we wanted that for the next 2 years. I think you're absolutely right. The big political point here is that if she gets this money, she doesn't have to raid the dedicated funds, which had been a bit of a bone of contention between her and Republicans. So it's a good thing for her if she can close the FY13, the June 30th fiscal year deficit with that money.
And Dean, could this mean then maybe a little boost for the casino bill if we're looking at the money being used this year and not in the next fiscal budget?
Well, maybe in the sense that that would make if they're going to lose, I think the figure I saw was something like $24 million in the next 2 years that was included. If they're going to lose that money, that sort of raises the imperative of that $80 million looks even more important. Absolutely.
That's an interesting development. So, Kevin, I wanted to ask you, there's a hearing that gets underway today in Stafford County Superior Court on the constitutionality of the state's education tax credit program. So what is this case looking at?
Well, American Civil Liberties Utilities Union filed the suit with some individual plaintiffs, and they essentially challenged that the education tax credit amounts to an unconstitutional support of private and religious education. The supporters of the education tax credit say there are 9 states that have these tax credits. Several of these states have had constitutional arguments against them, and the tax credit has been upheld. Essentially, their argument is that this is not outright cash given from taxpayers to private and religious schools. These are contributions from owners of businesses that want to give to scholarships that support students to go to these schools.
So it's not state money.
That's correct. And in other states, that argument has been upheld as constitutional. These tax credits have withstood legal challenge in other states. Supporters of the tax credit are confident that ultimately they'll win. They think they could lose in Superior Court, but they believe the Supreme Court would uphold their law.
And Dan Toohey, last week the Senate voted 13-11 to table House Bill 370 related to this. So is all the action pretty much going to be in the courts now? It's pretty much the legislature not going anywhere.
Well, the bill was tabled, as you mentioned. We knew with given the Republican caucus and their point on it that either they were going to table it or perhaps defeat that bill. The House Bill 2, the trailer bill, the House attached that bill or that part of that legislation to the trailer bill. So it is still alive.
It's still out there.
But what really surprised me, Sarah, was during the Senate debate, it was a very emotional debate. Hmm. You had some folks like Chuck Morse mentioned his daughter goes to a Catholic school. It was her decision. Supports it, and it was one of those things like he's done well as a businessman. It's like it's a school choice issue, according to supporters. Mm-hmm. It's not this raiding of taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say this: the larger context here is a long-running debate over school vouchers and whether or not students should have, as Dan said, choice. Have the opportunity
again, a debate
to
we've heard before.
Yeah,
as you mentioned.
Exactly. These things come around again and again. This is a somewhat different, a little bit more complicated version of it. But that's essentially the arguments you're hearing for and against are, you know, this is it's not a choice issue. It's basically taking tax dollars and giving parents vouchers so their kids can go to private or parochial schools.
And Kevin Landrigan, you were writing this week, I saw a little bit looking at some efforts to get more companies to participate in this program.
Yeah, that's right. There are a couple of companies that are involved in soliciting business owners to donate scholarships. The Network for Education Opportunity is made the most ground to this point. They don't have a lot of time because the Department of Revenue Administration actually requires these tax credits to be logged in by June 15th for the next school year.
Okay, we're taking a short break now, but coming up, more of your calls and more topics on the New Hampshire Friday News Roundup.
39, you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. At 10 o'clock, it's the Diane Rehm Show, frustration over sequester-related air travel problems. That's on the domestic hour. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Unity Homes from Bensonwood, designed to improve the world by enhancing quality of life and reducing energy consumption. Information at unityhomes.com. And from the Woodstock Inn, Station, and Brewery, proud to feature its new 170-seat function room for weddings and other special events. Details at woodstockinnnh.com. This is NHPR.
Our goal is to leave a living legacy to organizations we love and respect.
Woolsey Conover of Holderness, New Hampshire, is a lifetime listener of public radio.
While we are here on this earth, it's our privilege to support them. And when we depart, we will have the joy and satisfaction of knowing that our support goes on. That's why we have established a state plan that includes New Hampshire Public Radio.
For more information about NHPR's planned giving program, visit nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Sarah Ashworth, in for Laura Kanoy. Monday on The Exchange, we have a new book released that looks at President Calvin Coolidge's legacy. You can email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. But today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're talking about all of the events that made news in this state this week. And all of us last week were glued to our TV screens, listening to the radio as the city of Boston was shut down and a manhunt was underway. A week later, we're still learning more about what happened, including that the bombers bought 2 reloadable mortar kits at a New Hampshire fireworks outlet. Dan Toohey, what do you know about this?
Well, yeah, the two suspects, the brothers, came up and they purchased some fireworks from some mortar bases, it sounds like, from the Seabrook store. You know, whether or not they were used to practice their alleged bombings here or somehow.
Right, it sounds like the black powder would not be enough to have done what they did.
Or whether they were trying to, you know, again, we don't know. I don't want to speculate, but the fact that they were there and the clerks of the store remembered them. It was really fascinating interviews with the store clerks.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Landrigan, we saw that Senators Ayotte and McCain, they want a U.S. Senate committee to investigate whether U.S. intelligence officials had information that could have prevented the bombing.
Yeah, there's sort of been some troubling developments since the bombing has occurred, whether in fact some of these smokestacks have developed between agencies. They're either not cooperating or not communicating. And in the case of suspect number one, we had the CIA actually put this person on the watch list after Russia had reported to the FBI that they had real concerns about this guy who came from Chechnya, whether he had actually radicalized as an Islamic terrorist and was planning a trip back to Russia and back to Chechnya. The FBI investigated the matter. They essentially didn't find anything, but the CIA differed and put him on the watch list. So that's what the senators want to examine.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, whenever we have these kinds of terrible tragedies, I always look to see kind of what political ripples vibrate out from the center. And we're seeing a couple of different things already just in the last few weeks. The first thing is the potential impact of this on the immigration debate. It's giving conservatives who in Congress who feel like they were losing ground on the issue because of public sentiment an opportunity to say, hey, let's wait a minute. We really have to rethink about how we grant citizenship, how people are allowed access into the country, et cetera, et cetera. The second thing is what Kevin was talking about. Is this always kicks up a storm of congressional oversight. So we're going to have another vetting of the national security bureaucracy, the intelligence bureaucracy. You know, we saw it back with 9/11. You remember President Bush had that daily briefing about al-Qaeda using planes and, you know, how come that wasn't taken seriously. All those kinds of debates spring up, and it becomes a very ideological polarizing. So, you know, Democrats were chomping at the bit for Bush, and now we're seeing Republicans like Kelly Ayotte and John McCain who are clamoring for oversight for why one of the brothers who clearly had gained the attention of the FBI and the CIA was not followed more closely. So I think there are going to be some sort of significant political ramifications. It is kind of viewed as sort of the first big blemish, terrorism blemish of the Obama administration. And so Republicans have kind of seized that as, you know, whether or not they were not paying sufficient attention. The third thing I'll throw out, and this is a little bit different, is the media coverage of this has been absolutely fascinating. I mean, it really points to a fundamentally transformed notion of how we learn about stories. I mean, we really watch this in real time, right? Everybody's got video cameras and cell phones and surveillance cameras. It really has become almost like a participatory experience now where we all kind of track down the bad guys together. It's just quite remarkable to watch.
Yeah, a lot of nods around the room here, I see now. Kevin Landrigan, some state representatives at the end of their session on Wednesday, they started singing a rendition of Sweet Caroline. I'm not sure how sweet the sound of it was, but why did they do that?
Yeah, I think it was a way for New Hampshire to really mark some solidarity with Massachusetts. And certainly, as we know, with some of these victims, there have been New Hampshire connections, certainly. Sean Collier, the MIT police officer who was killed by the bombers, he married a woman from Exeter. They were married in New Hampshire. He talked a lot with friends about spending weekends hiking in New Hampshire all the time. Loved to visit the state. Of course, one of the iconic photographs from this bombing involved a man from Chelmsford, Massachusetts, Jeffrey Bowman, whose family is from Concord, whose brothers live in Concord. And, of course, it's that photo of the man in the cowboy hat rushing him off as he's been injured. And unfortunately, the bomb caused him to lose both his legs below the knee. So New Hampshire is really feeling a lot of pain for folks. And certainly Governor Hassan indicated that during a moment of silence that was observed earlier this week in the Hall of Flags, where almost 200 people gathered to mark the occasion.
Dan Tuohy, were you there on Wednesday?
I was. I captured some of the video of the Sweet Caroline. Bum, bum, bum. And you know, they sang Pretty well. And it was actually, I asked, you know, the speaker's office, like, how did that come about? It was a very organic thing, it turns out. A couple of reps was like, we should do this just as a Boston Strong, show some bipartisan love to Boston and the victims and whatnot. And if you, you know, it was a couple of Republicans and Democrats up front as chorus leaders, if you will. And it was a very nice moment to a very sad couple of weeks.
Some of the video I saw, lawmakers were standing, many were hugging, swaying.
Yeah, it was really well done. And of course, you know, people talk about the meaning of that song and what it means about loss and redemption, and the fact that everyone knows the song. It was fun.
All right. So we also had some tough news out of the newspaper industry this week. The Union Leader will now be published by the Seacoast Media Group. That means, unfortunately, there are layoffs for about 34 pressmen and some part-time mailroom workers. Last week, we also learned of layoffs at the Nashua Telegraph. It was a tough week for the print news business. Kevin Landrigan?
Yeah, certainly. I think the news media in general is trying to come to grips with the new paradigm that exists in communication. Sort of Dean alluded to it earlier about the reaction to the bombings. People get their information in a variety of ways today, and so it's very difficult for newspapers and for any media outlet, if you will, to hold customers, to keep customers committed to your brand. So we're all dealing with that, and certainly in the case of newspapers, trying to make even greater use of the internet to keep customers, to increase readers. It used to be all about how many people buy the product that leaves the ink stains on your hands. Now it's about eyeballs. It's about really where the money is in newspapers, essentially, is how many people are looking at your website. That's where you're generating some of the new income that's coming to newspapers.
Yeah, Kevin, I always ask my students every term, how many of you read newspapers? Not a single hand goes up in the room. So this is a generational thing. We're really seeing kind of the slow death of print media and a rise of these other platforms. And the business model challenge is figuring out how to harness all of these sort of diverse ways of getting information into something that's profitable. And I think that the sort of access to information and news is much more democratic now, but it's a lot harder to build an industry off of it. And you guys are both sort of on the front lines of that, but I see it as well, just kind of from my perspective.
And it was interesting last week, as you mentioned, as the news of the Boston Marathon bombing unfolded and so much was wrong that was initially reported, that really for me, I found that reading a newspaper the next day where things had been synthesized a bit and figured out was really helpful and valuable.
I've had that conversation with a number of pretty well-known journalists over the years, and every time we talk about it, they say, look, we just have less and less time to get this stuff up. We don't really have the leisure to spend 2 or 3 days verifying sources because it's so competitive. You got Drudge, you got all these other websites that are just throwing stuff up right away. I mean, it really started, I think, with Monica Lewinsky. That was when we really sort of, the first time where I think Drudge went up with like one source or something, and then that really kind of broke the dam. And now, you know, we saw this situation where, you know, CNN said that they had been held, they were arrested, and it turns out that wasn't true, and they sort of just kind of kept going, whereas in another time, that would have been a much bigger faux pas.
Well, back to the State House here for a minute. Over the past couple of weeks, a few lawmakers have been making news in ways that they probably didn't want to. Last week, it was Representative Peter Hansen in an email comment about women. This week, it was Representative Stella Tremblay talking about the Boston Marathon bombings, and also Representative Dick Patton, who had a restraining order brought against him. Let's start with Stella Tremblay. Dan Toohey, tell us what she said and how it went all over the internet.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. You know, state reps are very well-spoken. Many of them are very articulate. But sometimes when they're not so articulate, it's social media gets in the way. In this case, it was a Facebook comment on Friday before the second suspect was captured. And it was State Rep Stella Tremblay, Republican from Auburn, mentioned to the effect that she was questioning, but it was a statement she made on Facebook to Glenn Beck's Facebook page saying the attack was a black ops staged event. Orchestrated possibly by the U.S. government. And, of course, that got picked up, and it went viral very quickly, as you can imagine. And we talked to her on Wednesday after the House session, and she essentially stood by her remarks saying that, you know, the public really needs to dig further, and, of course, the press. And she points to what Dean was saying about that John King report a week ago that, you know, that the second suspect has been captured or a suspect's in custody, which was false. So there's all these like flags that there's always more to the story, that especially when something's developing on such a horrific tragedy, people wanting information right away. And if they don't get it right away, you know, these questions arise. But as investigators say, even on low-level crimes, they don't show their cards because they're investigating. They don't want to give anything away.
And her comments were, they were condemned universally right away by Republicans and Democrats in the state. House Republican leader Jean Chandler called her comments highly offensive, egregious, and irrational. This was the same case with Peter Hansen a week or so ago, too, right, Kevin?
Yes, it was. I mean, this is certainly a concern for the House Republican minority in the legislature and in general for the state Republican Party that suffered some pretty difficult defeats last November. They very much do not want they don't want the people in New Hampshire to see essentially the GOP hijacked by a very conservative kind of Tea Party flavor. That's not – they know that's not their winning message, and they believe that some of the defeats they suffered last November were largely a function of that, some of the very hard conservative positions that were taken by the Republican-led legislature over the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's. I take two things away from this. One, the first thing is this issue of social media and technology. In the old days, if somebody made a comment like this, it would be very easy for other legislators to ostracize that individual and kind of push them aside. But now, with the social media and internet technology, Facebook, Twitter, Representative Tremblay can kind of double down because she's getting support from other parts of the country where people are, you know, emailing and saying, "Hey, we're right with you. We don't trust what the government is saying." So this is this idea that, you know, kind of like-minded individuals around the country can now form a more supportive group. So you're less likely to see people back down, which makes the sort of political environment more complicated. The second thing is, and I get this, people ask me all the time, how do people like this get elected? Well, in a small state with 400 representatives, even though we don't have straight ticket voting anymore, most people, and I've heard this from them, when they go to vote for their local representative, they often don't really know beyond kind of party or a vague sense who that person is. So every 2 years, although she's a second term rep, I believe, every 2 years, there's always some interesting people who kind of come out of that 400-person legislature. And it's just a function of the average person doesn't have time to, you know, carefully research every individual. You know, maybe she's had these kind of views before and they just haven't really kind of permeated out.
One thing also I wanted to say is when you have a legislature where the average age approaches 60, to Dean's point with regard to social media, many of these folks fail to understand that the axiom about the social media, which is you don't want to write something in an email that you wouldn't want on the front page of the Union Leader or the National Telegraph the next day. You have to be very judicious about the commentary that you make here. But many folks, and of course, younger people certainly understand this, I think, better than older people do, that because younger people have come in with this generation of the ubiquitous nature of social media, the notion that you have to be very cautious in the commentary you make there.
And Dan Toohey, Representative Dick Patton, a Concord Democrat, was also in the news this week. A judge granted a temporary stalking petition against him. What was that about, and what's going on with that?
Yes, the Concord Monitor broke the story, I believe it was Wednesday or Tuesday,
right,
and just looked at a person that took out an order or a petition that Representative Patton, who's also a city councilor in Concord, cannot go near this individual, the 20-year-old man apparently from Concord. You know, there's some allegations that are pretty sordid.
Lawmakers seem pretty cautious, though, right now, and kind of waiting to see what happens and waiting for a hearing in May.
Yes, May 10th is a hearing, and you know, Dick Patton has an attorney, Mark Sisti, who says, "Look, we want to get to this hearing to clear this thing up." But yeah, the city councilors and fellow state reps are like, anytime you have something that's like this, it's very sensitive. They're trying to take it one step at a time.
Yeah, I think Dick Patton certainly did the smart thing, which was to get a Barracuda defense lawyer. I mean, Mark Sisti is extremely good, and this victim, if you will, certainly acknowledged that he didn't discourage a lot of the contact early on that he had with Representative Patton. So and took a number of personal loans from him. So you can fully expect Sisti to go all after him to try and improve the case for his client.
So we'll have to wait until early May, like many lawmakers, like everybody, to figure out exactly what's going on. We just have a couple of minutes. Let's look quickly. There was some new poll numbers out. We've heard this news about Scott Brown as a possible challenger to Senator Jean Shaheen. Poll out this week from the Democratic North Carolina firm Public Policy Polling, though, shows Brown would trail Shaheen by 11 points. Dean Spiliotis, are you following this?
Absolutely. You know, we all want to talk about the next election, so we needed something, and Scott Brown very graciously provided us a lot of fodder. I think he's having fun with this to some extent. And it's also been an opportunity for Democrats to start raising money. I think the minute he showed up in New Hampshire, fundraising letters went out from the Democratic Party to help stop Scott Brown. You know, the sense is that, you know, technically he could run. He does own a house here. He pays property tax. Apparently he has some family here. But for me, the big issue is the kind of adjustment in the kind of political narrative that would have to take place in the state. The idea that, you know, when have you ever heard Scott Brown talk about what happens in the federal government as having an impact on New Hampshire, right? We think of him as Massachusetts. He's never been involved in any political or policy debates in New Hampshire. And one of the funny things that came out of that public policy polling poll is 63% of those polled say that Scott Brown is not a New Hampshireite. So that's what I'm talking about, is having to overcome that perception that he would be a carpetbagger, even though we have seen times where people have been able to pull it off. And Shaheen has been a very sort of strong, tenacious politician for a long time. So I would love to see that race. I think the bigger problem for Republicans is, you know, the shape of their bench once you get past this issue. You know, would Jeb Bradley be the likely candidate, or you know, Ginta, or one of the others? They've got to figure that out.
No, Scott Brown's an unconventional politician. That's it. You know, he took down Ted Kennedy. You know, don't count him up for anything. But you're right, and we'll see that the other policy poll was the AOP poll that showed her down under fire after that background vote.
Kevin, very quickly, what are you watching next week? What are you tracking?
Well, certainly we're weighed in on probably the stand your ground vote in the Senate, and also on the continuing battles over the budget.
All right. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And the Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. I'm Sarah Ashworth in for Laura Kanoy. And I want to thank our guests today, Kevin Landrigan, State House and political reporter for the Nashua Telegraph, Dean Spiliotis, civil scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Dan Tuohy. He's assistant regional editor for Patch.com in New Hampshire. And we're going to end this hour with a little Sweet Caroline.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
It's 9:59, the Diane Rehm Show, just ahead on New Hampshire Public Radio, whose support comes from you, our members, and from A&B Lumber and Home Centers, featuring windows and doors by Marvin and Integrity for remodeling and replacement projects in Pembroke, Moultonburg.